of the drill, regulation issue, covered in the manual. All holes in the argument were immediately vulcanized by the heat of the emotion. This was no time to sit around waiting for the orders to be posted on the bulletin board. It was only 3 weeks before Scott's flight, and he was in the thick of training, but on May 3rd, most of the others went to see Lyndon Johnson at his ranch in Texas to try to straighten the matter out. Webb was there, too. They had quite a conclave. Lyndon Johnson gave them some fatherly discourses on private lives and public responsibility, twisting his great hands around in the air in front of them as if making imaginary snowballs. This pained him as much as it did them, and so on. The hell of it was that neither Johnson nor Webb would miss a minute's sleep if the life deal was canceled forthwith. They had both been burned by the astronaut life connection during the incident at the Glenn's house in January. In fact, if it hadn't been for Glenn, fortunately, there was no getting around John. By now, 3 months after his flight, John had ascended to a status that only a biblical scholar could fully appreciate. John was the triumphant single combat warrior. He had risked his life to challenge the mighty Soviet integral on the high ground. Through his skill and courage, he had neutralized the enemy's advantage, and the tears of joy and gratitude and awe still flowed. In the Bible, the first book of Samuel, 18th chapter, it is written that after David slew Goliath and the Philistines fled in terror, and the Israelites achieved a mighty victory, King Saul took David into the royal household and gave him the status of an adopted son. It is also written that wherever Saul and David went, people thronged the streets, and the women sang of the thousands Saul had slain, and the tens of thousands David had slain, as Saul was very wroth. And the saying displeased him, and he said, "They have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. And what can he have more but the kingdom?" And Saul eyed David from that day forward, and President Kennedy eyed John Glenn. The president had begun to regale John and bring him into the Kennedy family orbit. John was the sort of man a president needed to keep squarely within his camp. A vice president, too, for that matter. Johnson had gone out of his way to be friendly to John and Annie, and they had genuinely begun to like the man. They wound up inviting Johnson and his wife, Lady Bird, for dinner at their house in Arlington on John's 40th birthday. And the Johnsons accepted, just like that. Renee and Scott were also invited. "What on earth are you going to serve?" Renee said to Annie. "My ham loaf," said Annie. "Ham loaf? Why not? Everybody likes it. I bet you Lady Bird asked for the recipe, too." The Johnsons stayed until almost midnight. Lyndon had his coat off and his sleeves rolled up, and he was having a rare old time for himself. As they left, Renee heard Lady Bird ask Annie for the recipe for her ham loaf. One day, John was out on the Atlantic Ocean, beyond the Hyannisport, Massachusetts harbor, aboard the president's yacht, the Honey Fitz, when the subject of the life contract came up. The president wanted to know what John thought of one particular argument against the life arrangement that was frequently presented, namely that a soldier in battle, a Marine at Iwo Jima, for example, ran just a greater risk of death as any astronaut and yet did not expect recompense from time incorporated. John said yes, that was so, but suppose that soldier's or Marine's private life, his background, his house, his way of living, his wife, his children, his thoughts, his hopes, his dreams became of such intense interest that the press camped on his doorstep and he had to live under glass, as it were. Then he should have the right to receive compensation. The president nodded sagaciously, and the life contract was saved right there on the Honey Fitz. Well, thanks to the life deal, Scott and Renee could now get mortgage money and afford to build a new house in a nice area like Timber Cove. Or thanks to that and the panting eagerness of the developers to have astronauts in their new developments. It was the best advertisement they could have. They gave the boys close to at-cost deals on the land and the houses, and they let them have the mortgage money at 4%, with very little down payment. And for astronauts like John and Scott, who had now flown, they couldn't do enough. The contractors and developers and the public generally thought Scott and his flight were terrific. But within NASA, something was going on. Scott and Renee had both begun to detect it. Although no one ever said anything openly, Scott had gotten all the medals and all the parades and the trip to the White House, but something was up, and not even the other wives would tell Renee what it was. Scott had flown on May 24th, 3 months after John. Deke Slayton had been scheduled to take the flight, but then NASA made it known that Deke had a medical problem, idiopathic atrial fibrillation. This was a condition in which the electrical firing sequence of the heart went out of sync occasionally, causing an irregular pulse and slight lowering of the pumping capacity of the organ. Idiopathic meant that the causes were unknown. The condition had been discovered, said NASA, during centrifuge runs in August 1959. Slayton had been examined at the Philadelphia Navy Hospital and the Air Force's School of Aviation Medicine at San Antonio, where the verdict, or so Slayton was told, was that the condition was a minor anomaly and not serious enough to cost him his job as astronaut. But in fact, one of the Air Force doctors at San Antonio, a highly regarded cardiologist, had written a letter to Webb recommending that Slayton not be assigned to a flight, since atrial fibrillation, idiopathic or not, did reduce the efficiency of the heart to some degree. Webb just kept the letter on file. Slayton was assigned in November 1961 to the second orbital flight. Early in January, Webb ordered a complete reassessment of the man's heart condition. His argument was that Slayton was an Air Force pilot on loan to NASA, and an Air Force cardiologist had recommended that he not be used for flights. Therefore, the case should be reviewed. Slayton's case now went before two boards, one made up of high-ranking NASA doctors, and the other made up of eight doctors convened by the Air Force Surgeon General. Both approved Slayton for the approaching Mercury flight. Nevertheless, Webb bucked the case up to three Washington cardiologists, including Eugene Braunwald of the National Institutes of Health, as a sort of blue-ribbon panel. He also requested an opinion from Paul Dudley White, who had become famous as Eisenhower's cardiologist. Why this was happening so late in the game, 3 months after Deke had been assigned to the flight, no one could figure. All four doctors came to the same conclusion, apparently out of sheer common sense as much as anything else. Here was a case concerning a pilot with a minor heart defect. He could probably make a space flight or any other flight with no problem. Nevertheless, from the administrator on down, the entire space agency seemed to be agonizing and oscillating and spinning its wheels over the matter, which by now had accumulated a file as thick as your arm. So if Project Mercury had plenty of ready and willing astronauts with no cardiovascular anomalies at all, why not use one of them and have done with it? That was it, so far as Webb was concerned. It was now the middle of March. 2 months ago, in his set two with Glenn, James E. Webb had run up against AstroPower and had lost. This time, he had his way. Slayton was off the flight. The great Victorian animal was utterly baffled. The animal had been dutifully cranking out human interest stories about Slayton. How could NASA decide now that he was a washout with a bad heart? There was no proper emotion for the event. According to the official NASA wording, Slayton was keenly disappointed about the decision. That was putting it somewhat delicately. The man was furious. Slayton tried to keep a rein on himself in public statements, however, because he didn't want to jeopardize his chances of reinstatement. He was convinced that the whole thing had somehow been blown up into a specious issue and that they would all come to their senses by and by. Privately, he was tying knots in the flagpole. He kept saying that Paul Dudley White had made an operational decision. His argument was that White and the other doctors had first delivered their medical opinion, he was fit to fly, and then they had delivered their operational opinion, which was, even so, why not choose somebody else? They were entitled to their medical opinion, period, but they had made an operational decision. This word, operational, was a holy word to Slayton. He was the king of operational. Operational referred to action, the real thing. Piloting, the right stuff. Medical referred to one of the many accessories to the business at hand. You didn't call in doctors to make an operational decision. The life reporters knew very well how angry Slayton was, and other reporters had strong hints of it. But the genteel beast could find no appropriate tone for it. So after a short time, they just dropped it. They stuck with the NASA version, keenly disappointed. Few of them realized that it went beyond anger. Deke Slayton was crushed. He had not merely lost his ride on the next flight, he had lost everything. NASA had just announced that he no longer had the right stuff. It could blow at any scene, and his had blown. Idiopathic atrial fibrillation. It didn't matter. Any scene, his whole career. His ascension from the dour, grim tundra of Wisconsin was based upon his indisputable possession of that righteous stuff. That was the most important thing he had ever possessed in his trough of mortal error. And it was plenty. It was the ultimate. And it had blown, just like that. He felt humiliated. The thing would now be rubbed in his face everywhere he turned. He couldn't go back to Edwards now, even if he wanted to. The Air Force was not going to use a NASA reject for major flight test work. Flight test? Hell, he couldn't even fly a fighter plane by himself anymore. It was true. He could go up only in two-seaters with another pilot, someone who was still intact, with no ruptured seams from which his vital stuff had leaked. There was even the possibility that the Air Force might ground him altogether, notwithstanding the fact that the Surgeon General's board had pronounced him fully qualified as an Air Force pilot and as an astronaut. Air Force pride was at stake. The Air Force's chief of staff himself, General Curtis LeMay, was taking the position that if he wasn't qualified to fly for NASA, how could he be qualified to fly for the Air Force? All this was being said about him. Deke Slayton, who had fought hardest of all to have the astronaut be treated as a pilot, even to the extent of insisting on airplane-style controls for the capsule, or rather, damn it, spacecraft. It wasn't likely to make him any happier, either, to know that Scott Carpenter had taken his place. Carpenter had the least flight test experience of any of them, and yet he was replacing Deke Slayton. Deke Slayton, who had stood up before the Society of Experimental Test Pilots and insisted that only an experienced test pilot could do this job correctly. Wally Schirra, a man with real flight test credentials, had been training as Deke's backup. Why had he been passed over in favor of Carpenter? The two buddies, Glenn and Carpenter, were getting the first two orbital flights, and Deke Slayton was being left behind to hitch airplane rides with other pilots. Gilruth's opinion, backed up by Walt Williams, was that Carpenter had logged far more flight training as Glenn's backup than Schirra could possibly hope to cram in during the 10 weeks remaining before the flight. Scott was not exactly ecstatic over having been handed Deke's flight on such short notice. He had trained for 6 months with John, but the second orbital flight was to be quite a different proposition. NASA's experimental scientist would finally have an inning. The astronaut was supposed to deploy a multicolored balloon outside the capsule in order to study the perception of light in space and the amount of drag, if any, in the presumed vacuum of space. He was supposed to observe how water in a glass bottle behaved in a weightless state and whether or not capillary action was altered. There would be a small glass sphere for that experiment. He would have a densitometer, as it was known, to measure the visibility of a ground flare. He would be trained in the use of a handheld camera to take weather photographs and pictures of the daylight horizon and the atmospheric band above the horizon and of various land masses, particularly North America and Africa. They had the right man, Scott was intrigued by the experiments. But the addition of all these things to the checklist, which was already undergoing last-minute changes of the operational sort, put him under increasing pressure. In making all of these sightings for the use of the camera, the densitometer, or whatever, he would be using an entirely new manual control apparatus. It was a system in which you created 1 pound of thrust if you pushed the hand controller slightly, and 25 more if you pushed it beyond a small angle. It would be either or. There would be no turning the capsule gradually like an airplane or an automobile. The flight went off on schedule on May 24th. For the first two orbits, Scott had a picnic. He was more relaxed and in higher spirits than any of the three men who had preceded him. He was enjoying himself. His pulse rate before liftoff, during the launch, and in orbit was even lower than Glenn's. He talked more, ate more, drank more water, and did more with the capsule than any of them ever had. He obviously loved all the experiments. He was swinging the capsule this way and that way, taking photographs a mile a minute, making detailed observations of the sunrises and horizon, releasing balloons, tending his bottles, taking readings with the densitometer, having a grand time. The only problem was that the new control system used up fuel at a terrific rate. You wanted to pitch or yaw the capsule just ever so slightly, and bingo, you were over the invisible line, and another outsized geyser of hydrogen peroxide squirted out of the tanks. During the second orbit, he was warned by several Capcoms to start conserving fuel, so that he would have enough for re-entry. But it was not until the third and last orbit that he himself seemed to realize just how low the fuel was. For most of the final orbit, he just let the capsule drift and turn in any attitude it wanted to, so as not to have to use any of the thrusters, high or low, automatic or manual. It presented no problems at all. Even when you were upside down in relation to the Earth with your head pointed straight down, there was no feeling of disorientation, no feeling of up or down. Floating in a weightless state was even more enjoyable than swimming underwater, which Scott loved. The diminished fuel capacity was very much on his mind. Still, he couldn't resist the opportunity to experiment. He reached for the densitometer, and his hand hit the latch of the capsule, and a cloud of John Glenn's fireflies appeared outside the window. So he swung the capsule over in a yaw to have a look at the fireflies. To him, they looked more like frost or snowflakes. So he banged on the hatch, and another cloud flew up, and he swung around some more to take a look and used up some more fuel. Whatever they were attached to the hull of the capsule and no doubt emanated from and were created by the capsule, and were not some sort of micro-galaxy, all of which aroused his curiosity. And so he banged away and pitched and yawed and tooled around some more, the better to unravel the mystery. All of a sudden, it was time to prepare for re-entry, and Scott was already behind in the retro sequence, as that part of the checklist was known. Also, the fuel situation was beginning to get a little dicey. On top of that, the automatic control system would no longer hold the capsule at the proper angle for re-entry, so he switched to fly-by-wire, but at the same time forgot to throw the switch that cut off the manual system. For 10 minutes, he was eating up fuel out of both systems. He would have to fire the retro rockets manually, as Alan Shepard, the Capcom in Arguello, California, sounded off the countdown. When Shepard called Fire 1, the capsule's angle was off about 9 degrees, and Scott was late in hitting the switch. He had practically no fuel left for controlling the capsule's oscillations during re-entry. By the time he hit the denser atmosphere and the radio blackout began, Chris Kraft and the other flight control engineers feared the worst. Long after radio communication should have been resumed, nothing. It looked as if Carpenter had consumed all his fuel up there, playing around, and had burned up. They all looked at each other and were already thinking one step ahead. This disaster is going to set the program back a year, or do worse than that. Renee was following Scott's re-entry over television inside a rented house in Cocoa Beach. For 2 days, she had been involved in a hide-and-seek operation that had finally become absolutely loony. Bridge dragnets, amok helicopters, Renee had decided that since life's accounts of the brave wives bravely enduring the ordeal of their husbands' flights were written in the first person, she was actually going to write hers. Loudon Wainwright could edit what she wrote and rewrite the rough spots, but she was going to write the whole thing herself. That being the case, she wasn't going to let herself be imprisoned inside her house at Langley by the television crews and all the rest of that madness. She had seen Annie being driven far crazier from having to play quavering pigeon for the press and the likes of Lyndon Johnson than by any fear she had for John. It was an undignified position to be in. Despite the attention lavished on you, you were not treated as an individual, but as the anxious, loyal mate of the male up on top of the rocket. After a while, Renee didn't know whether it was her modest literary ambitions or her resentment of the pat role of astronaut wife that made her do it. Life rented a safe house for her in Cocoa Beach. Life did things right. They rented a backup safe house as well, in case Renee's presence in the first one was discovered. Renee called Shorty Powers, who was NASA's official press officer in matters concerning the astronauts, and told him that she was going to the Cape for the launch, but wanted privacy and was telling no one where she would be, including him. Powers was not happy. The astronaut's life contract had already made his job difficult enough. He was cut off from all personal material about the men and their families, since that was supposed to go to life exclusively. And yet, when a flight was on, 90% of the reporters Powers had to deal with were really interested in only two questions. What is the astronaut doing now, and how does he feel? Is he afraid? And, two, what is the wife doing now, and how does she feel? Is she dying from anxiety? One of Powers' main roles was serving the television networks and telling them where the wife would be during the flight so that they could congregate for the Death Watch campout. And this time, all he could tell them was that the wife would be at the Cape somewhere. That did it. The networks took the situation as an insult and a challenge. Before Renee left for the Cape, a correspondent for one of the networks called her and told her that they were going to find out where she was staying. They could do it the hard way if they had to, but they'd rather do it the easy way. So she'd better just tell them. It was like something out of a gangster movie. But sure enough, when she reached the Cape, the networks had people watching every bridge and causeway into Cocoa Beach. Renee knew they would be looking for a car with a woman with four children, so she had the children lie on the floor, and they slipped through. The networks were not going to be foiled that easily. After all, how could they camp on her front lawn and film her drawn shades if they didn't even know where she was? So they hired helicopters and began scouring Cocoa Beach. They went up and down the hardtack beach looking for congregations of four small children. They would swoop right down on children on the beach until they could read the terror in their eyes. People were running for cover, abandoning their scotch coolers and telescopes and cameras and tripods, trying to save their children from the amok helicopters. It was crazy, utterly bananas, but by now, not knowing where the wife was, it was like not knowing where the rocket was. Finally, Renee was sending her children over to the beach two by two in order to foil the insane people in the network helicopters. Came time for the launch, and now Renee and the children watched the countdown on the TV in the safe house, with Wainwright and a life photographer in attendance. Then the children rushed out and watched part of the rocket's slow ascent through a telescope mounted on a garage roof. The children didn't seem at all apprehensive. Flying was what their father did. They were in high spirits, and now they were following the re-entry as best they could on television. They had CBS turned on. There was Walter Cronkite. Renee knew him. Cronkite had become an astro buff. He had more than the usual reasons to like the astronauts. It was his coverage of John Glenn's flight that, in the strange workings of the television news business, had led to his current eminence among the network anchormen. Cronkite had been explaining Scott's fuel problem as he entered the atmosphere. Then Cronkite's voice began to take on more and more concern. They didn't know where Scott was. They weren't sure he had begun his re-entry at the proper angle. All at once, Cronkite's voice broke. Tears came into his eyes. I'm afraid that there was a catch in his voice. His eyes glistened. He had the waterworks turned on. I'm afraid we may have lost an astronaut. What instincts the man had. There was the press, the genteel gent coming up with the appropriate emotion, live, with no prompting whatsoever. Renee's children were very quiet, staring at the screen. Yet Renee herself did not believe for a moment that Scott had perished. She was like every military pilot's wife in that respect. If he were merely missing, if no dead body had been found, then he was alive and would come through it all right. There were no two ways about it. Renee had known of a case in which a cargo plane had crash-landed in the Pacific and broken in two on impact, the rear half sinking like a brick. Some men were rescued from the front half, which stayed afloat a few minutes. And yet the wives of the men who had been in the rear of the craft refused to believe that they were lost. They were out there somewhere. It was only a matter of time. Renee had marveled at how long it had taken them to accept the obvious. But her reaction was precisely the same. Scott was all right because there was no real proof that he wasn't. Cronkite gulped on the television screen. No tears came to her eyes at all. Scott was all right. He would turn up. No two ways about it. As a matter of fact, she was correct. Scott had come through the atmosphere in good shape. The capsule began rocking violently in the dense atmosphere below 50,000 feet, and he had to release the parachute early and by hand, the automatic system being out of fuel. The capsule had overshot the target area by some 250 miles. A reconnaissance plane found him in about 40 minutes, but throughout that period, the impression created on television was that he might be dead. When a rescue aircraft reached Scott, they found him bobbing contentedly on a life raft beside the capsule. He was very pleased with the whole adventure. When he reached the aircraft carrier Intrepid, he was in terrific spirits. He talked and talked into the night. He wanted to stay up and keep talking about the grand adventure he had been through. He was really pleased about all the experiments he had been able to do, despite the overcrowded checklist he had, and about solving or at least greatly narrowing down the mystery of the fireflies. He hadn't determined precisely what they were, but he had proved that they were produced by the spacecraft itself. They were not some extraterrestrial material and so on. He could have gone on all night. He was content. A job well done. He felt that he had helped create one of the most important roles in astronautics, man as scientist in space. Over the next 2 weeks, Scott received a hero's homage. It was not on the scale of John's, which was understandable, but it was sweet enough. There were parades in the east and parades in the west. He rode in a motorcade through Boulder, his old hometown, and through Denver, which was just down the highway. It was a great day. The sun was out, and it was a light, fluffy Rocky Mountain day in May, and Renee was beside him, sitting up on the ridge of the seat in the convertible, wearing white gloves, like a proper Navy wife, and smiling and looking absolutely beautiful and radiant. Well, Scott thought he had just shot the moon. Back at the Cape, Chris Kraft was telling his colleagues, "That son of a bitch will never fly for me again." Kraft was furious. The truth was, he had been quietly put out before about the seven brave lads. As he saw it, Carpenter had ignored repeated warnings from Capcoms all around the world about wasting fuel, and this had almost resulted in a disaster, one that might have done irreparable damage to the program. As it was, Carpenter's performance had cast doubt on the capability of the Mercury system to carry out a long flight such as Titov's 17 orbits. And why had this catastrophe nearly occurred? Because Carpenter had insisted on comporting himself like an omnipotent and omniscient Mercury astronaut. He didn't have to pay attention to suggestions and warnings from mere groundlings. He apparently believed that the astronaut, the passenger in the capsule, was the heart and soul of the space program. All of the resentment that the engineers had about the top, lofty status of the astronauts now crept out of its cage, at least within NASA. Outside of NASA, publicly, nothing was to change. Carpenter, like Grissom before him, was an exemplary, brave lad. Just a little dicey scrape at the end of the flight, that was all. Very successful flight. Go ahead. Let him have his medals and his receiving lines. And now that the wound had been opened, there were those who were only too pleased to see the following line develop concerning the Carpenter flight. Carpenter had not merely wasted fuel while up there playing with the capsule's attitude controls, doing his beloved experiments. No, he had also become rattled when he finally realized he was getting low on fuel. The evidence for this was that he forgot to turn off the manual system when he switched to fly-by-wire, and thereby really blew his fuel supply. And then he panicked. That was why he couldn't line the capsule up at the right angle, and that was why he couldn't fire the retro rockets right on the button, and that was why he hit the atmosphere at such a shallow angle. He nearly skipped off it instead of going through it. He nearly skipped off into eternity, because he panicked. There. We've said it. That was the worst charge that could be brought against a pilot on the Great Ziggurat of flying. It said that a man had lost whatever stuff he had in the most awful manner. He had funked it. It was a sin for which there was no redemption. Damned eternally. Once such a verdict had been pronounced, no judgment was too vile. Did you hear his voice on the tape just before the blackout? You could hear the panic. In fact, they could hear no such thing. Carpenter sounded very much the way Glenn had sounded, and a good deal less excited than Grissom. But if one wanted to hear panic, especially in the words that a man had to force out after the G-forces built up, if that was what one was after, then you could hear panic. But then Carpenter never had the right stuff to begin with. That much was obvious. He had given up long ago. He had opted for multi-engine planes. Now we know why. He had only 200 hours in jets. He was here only through a fluke in the selection process. And so forth and so on. Certain objective data had to be ignored, of course. Carpenter's pulse rate remained lower during the re-entry, as well as during the launch and orbital flight, than any other astronauts, including Glenn's. It never rose above 105, even during the most critical point of the re-entry. One could argue that pulse rate was not a dependable indication of a pilot's coolness. Scott Crossfield had a chronically rapid pulse rate, and he was in the league with Yeager. Nevertheless, it was inconceivable that a man in a state of panic, in a life-or-death emergency, in a crisis that did not last for a matter of seconds but for 20 minutes, it was inconceivable that such a man would maintain a heart rate of less than 105 throughout. Even a pilot's heart rate could jump to more than 105 for nothing more than the fact that some cocky bastard had cut into line ahead of him at the PX. One might argue that Carpenter had mishandled the re-entry, but to accuse him of panic made no sense in light of the telemetered data concerning his heart rate and his respiratory rate. Therefore, the objective data would be ignored. Once it had begun, the denigration of Carpenter had to proceed at any cost. It served many purposes at once. It made the rest of them seem like real pilots after all, and not mere writers in a pod. A man either had it or he didn't. In space, as in the air, as every pilot knew in his secret heart, deny it if you wish, it required washouts to make your own righteous stuff stand out. So was Carpenter by implication to be designated the washout? Logic no longer mattered, especially since none of this could be talked of openly in any case. Publicly, there were to be no flaws in the manned space program whatsoever. Sheer logic would have raised the question, why pick Carpenter and not Grissom? Grissom had lost the capsule and had then come back with the classic pilot's response to gross error. I don't know what happened. The machine malfunctioned. The telemetry showed that Grissom's heart was on the edge of tachycardia at times. Just before entry, his heart rate had reached 171 beats per minute. Even after Grissom was safe and sound on the carrier Lake Champlain, his heart rate was 160 beats a minute. His breathing was rapid. His skin was warm and moist. He didn't want to talk about it. He wanted to go to sleep. He was the clinical picture of a man who had abandoned himself to panic. Then why was not Grissom designated the washout, if anybody cared to find one? But logic had nothing to do with it. One was in the area of magical beliefs now. In his everyday life, doughty little Gus lived the life of the right stuff. He was a staunch bearer of the operational banner. Here Gus's fate and Deke's fate came together. Deke had said all along, you need a proven operational test pilot up there. Gus and Deke were great pals. For 3 years, they had flown together, hunted together, drunk together. Their children had played together. They were both committed to the holy word, operational. Shara was with them on this particular commitment, and Shepard threw his weight toward them, as did Cooper. Deke had plenty to be thankful to Shepard for. One day, Al had gotten the other boys together and said, listen, we've got to do something for Deke. We've got to do something to give him back his pride. Shepard's suggestion was that Deke be made a sort of chief of the astronauts, with an office and a title and official duties. They all went for the idea and took it to Gilruth, and in no time, Deke had the title Coordinator of Astronaut Activities. There may have been people at NASA who figured this would be a supernumerary make-work job for the fallen astronaut. If so, they underestimated Deke. He was far shrewder and more determined individual than his Wisconsin tundra manner let on. The job gave him something to channel his tremendous thwarted energy into. The NASA hierarchy was still a political vacuum, and Deke set about filling it with a vengeance, as it were. Soon Deke was a power inside NASA, a man to be reckoned with, and his motivation never varied. The more powerful he became, the better his chances of reversing the decision that prevented him from flying. Justice, simple operational justice, in the name of the right stuff. Operational. The word had new clout now, and a corollary to the theory of the Carpenter flight began to develop. Carpenter's flight agenda had been loaded with Larry Lightbulb experiments. The scientists, lowest men in the NASA pecking order up to now, had been given their heads on this flight, and the results were there for your inspection. Carpenter had taken all this mad professor stuff seriously, and that was what led to his problems. He became so wrapped up in his various observations that he fell behind in the checklist and became rattled and then blew it. All this science nonsense could wait. Just now, in the critical operational phase of the program, the crucial period of real flight test, it wasn't just ding-a-ling stuff. It was dangerous. There were too many goddamn doctors involved in this thing, too. Look at what they did to Deke. On top of that, they had the two psychiatrists to contend with. They were nice enough men personally, Ruff and Korchin were, but they were in the way. What the hell was all this pissing into bags and hitting little circles with a pencil? After you just hung your hideout over the edge in a spaceflight, they hadn't even picked up the fact that Carpenter had panicked. They found him exhilarated, alert, full of energy, ready to take off and do it all over again. The two men were not invited to continue with the program after the move from Langley to Houston. Thanks a lot, gentlemen, and do not let the doorknob hit you in the butt. Here the outlook of Grissom, Slayton, and Shara coincided with that of Kraft and Walt Williams. Kraft and Williams also felt that non-operational experiments should be kept to a minimum at this stage of the space program. From now on, whenever anyone said otherwise, one had only to roll his eyeballs and turn his palms up and say, you want another Carpenter flight? On August 11th and 12th, the mighty Integral struck again, and now there was absolutely no stopping the operational theory. On August 11th, the Soviets launched Vostok 3 on what at first looked as if it would be a repetition of Titov's day-long flight, but no. Exactly 24 hours later, the chief designer sent up Vostok 4, and the two craft flew together in tandem within 3 miles of each other, within 3 miles of one another in the infinity of space. The Soviets spoke of a group flight as if the two cosmonauts Diaghilev and Popovich were flying in formation. In fact, neither could change his flight path in the slightest, and their proximity was due solely to the precision with which the second Vostok was launched as the first came orbiting overhead. But even this seemed to be a feat of incalculable sophistication. The genteel beast and many congressmen seemed to be on the edge of hysteria. Entire formations of Soviet space warriors hurling thunderbolts at Schenectady, Grand Forks, Oklahoma City. Once again, the chief designer was toying with them. God knew what his next surprise would be. It would be a big one. Well, that settled it. No more densometers and vari-colored balloons and other white smock accessories. No more pilots with non-operational stuff. Which explained the singular nature of Wally Schirra's flight on October 3rd. Schirra named his capsule Sigma 7, and there you had it. Scott Carpenter had named his Aurora 7. Aurora, the rosy dawn, the dawn of the intergalactic age, the unknowns, the mystery of the universe, the music of the spheres, Petrarch on the mountaintop, and all that. Whereas Sigma was a purely engineering symbol. It stood for the summation, the solution of the problem. Unless he had come right out and named the capsule operational, he couldn't have chosen a better name. For the purpose of Schirra's flight was to prove that Carpenter's need not have happened. Schirra would make 6 orbits, twice as many as Carpenter, and yet use half as much fuel and land right on target. Whatever did not have to do with that goal tended to be eliminated from the flight. The flight of Sigma 7 was designed to be Armageddon, the final and decisive rout of the forces of experimental science in the manned space program. And that it was. Schirra cut the jolly, fun-loving figure so well that people sometimes failed to notice how formidable he could be. But his emphasis, after all, was on maintaining an even strain. His pranksterish, rib-shaking, wild-driving gotcha intervals gave him plenty of slack when the time came to wind things up tight and get tough. Every bit as much as Shepard, Wally had the instincts of an academy man, a leader of men, the commander, the captain of the ship. He merely operated in a different fashion. He was cool. He had the uncritical willingness to face danger, but he wasn't afraid to show his feelings when strategy seemed to dictate it. If it was going to be his show, he insisted on running it, and he was shrewd enough to recognize the political outlines of the situation. Having seen 4 flights from up close, Wally couldn't help but have noticed that the secret of a successful mission lay in a simplified checklist with white space between tasks. The fewer tasks you had, the better chance you had for a 100% performance. Not only that, if you could control the checklist, then you could give your flight a theme, a clear-cut goal that everyone could immediately appreciate and respond to. Wally's theme for his flight was operational precision, which, being translated, meant conserving fuel and landing on target. Now that the operational forces were lined up shoulder to shoulder, it was possible to keep off-board most travel items that engineers or scientists had dreamed up for the flight. It was decided that one of Wally's major operational tests would consist of powering down all of the attitude control systems, automatic as well as manual, and just drifting in any attitude the capsule's inertia took it, upside down in relation to the Earth, head over heels, canted this way and that, whatever. Scott heard about it and told Wally that he didn't really think it was necessary. He had drifted for most of his last orbit in an attempt to conserve fuel for the re-entry, and it proved to his own satisfaction that you could stand the capsule right up on its aerial and let it revolve or put yourself in any attitude, and it was not the least bit disorienting or uncomfortable. Why didn't Wally put the proposed drifting time to other uses? Wally said no. He was going to devote his flight to experimenting with drifting flight and to conserve fuel in order to prepare the way for missions of long duration. Scott would learn that planning sessions had been held, and he had not been informed of them. It was not that Scott was supposed to take any official part in the planning for Wally's flight, and it was not unusual in flight tests for a pilot to have his own particular circle of colleagues and ground crew he preferred to consult with. But be that as it may, anyone could recall how much Scott had valued John Glenn's counsel before his flight. In fact, one of Scott's concerns had been that John wasn't available more. The demands on John's time and his role as NASA's number one hero had become enormous. But any time John was around, Scott, and the engineers too, wanted John at the meetings. Wally also complained that John wasn't around. He caused quite a flap when he told Walter Cronkite in a taped interview that John was off on the banquet circuit so much he was lost to the program. He didn't complain about the absence of Scott, however. Scott began to conclude that Kraft and Williams were overreacting to the fact that he had overshot the target by 250 miles. The possibility that there were people, pilots, going around saying that he had panicked never even crossed his mind. Given the goal of the flight, which was to prove that a cool pilot could travel twice as far as Carpenter with half as much fuel consumption and 10 times the accuracy, Sherrod was terrific. From the moment he got up that morning, he was about as cool and relaxed a human being who ever went out to sit on top of a rocket shaft. A few days ago, Wally played one of his patented gotchas on Dee O'Hara, the nurse. One of her tasks was to collect urine samples. She gives him the usual little bottle and asks him to bring a sample and leave it on her desk. She comes into her office, and on top of the desk is not a little bottle, but a huge beaker holding about 5 gallons of amber liquid with a head of foam on top. It couldn't possibly be, but could it possibly be? And so she puts her hands on the sides of the beaker to see if it's warm, and gotcha. She wheels about, and there's Wally peeking in the doorway, him and his beaming face and a couple of the boys. He had concocted it of water, tincture of iodine, and detergent. The next day, Dee O'Hara presents Wally with a clear plastic bag, a big thing, about 4 feet long, telling him that it's the urine receptacle for his flight, replacing the little condom device that Grissom, Glenn, and Carpenter had worn. Gotcha! So today, the morning of his flight, here comes Wally down the hallway in Hangar S in his bathrobe, heading for the medical room. Flopping out below the robe and dragging along the floor between his legs is the huge plastic bag. He parades right past Dee O'Hara as if he were going to suit up that way. Gotcha. And he kept it up. That whole day, he was the Jolly Wally from beginning to end. He was amazing. He never sounded for a moment like someone under the stress of a novel form of flight test. It was like listening to a good buddy at beer call, recollecting in tranquility. He practically out-Jaegered Jaeger. As soon as the escape tower blew off, marking the successful completion of the fully powered part of his ascent, Sherrod saw it streaking through the sky and said, "This tower is a real sayonara." Chris Kraft, the flight director, gave his approval for the first orbit, and Deke Slayton, the capcom at the Cape, told Sherrod, "You have a go from Control Center." Sherrod said, "You have a go for me. It's real fat." Then Slayton said, "Are you a turtle today?" "Going to Vox recorder only," said Wally. Then he spoke into the tape recorder, whose microphone was not hooked into the open radio circuit. "You bet your sweet ass I am," he said. The Turtle Club was one of Wally's gotcha games. If one good buddy who played the turtle game met another good buddy in public, preferably in the company of very proper folk, and challenged him with the question, "Are you a turtle?" that good buddy had to answer, "You bet your sweet ass I am," in a loud voice, or else treat everybody else to a round of drinks. This was 3 minutes and 41 seconds into the flight. Wally was already maintaining an even strain. He buckled down to the task of conserving hydrogen peroxide. Ordinarily, when the booster rocket separated from the capsule was then turned around by the automatic control system, but this consumed considerable fuel. This time, Sherrod nudged it around manually, using only the low thrusters, the 5-pound thrusters, of the fly-by-wire system. Soon he was telling Deke at the Cape, "I'm in chimp mode right now, and she's flying beautifully." He started using this phrase, chimp mode. On the chimpanzee's flight, the attitude of the capsule had been controlled automatically throughout. The chimp mode was a little zinger for the benefit of all those on the mighty ziggurat, whether astronauts or X-15 dream pilots who were aware of the taunt. A monkey's gonna make the first flight? Shiraz's continual reference to the chimp mode as much as said, who cares? Here, I'll wave the bloody monkey in your face. As soon as he could, however, he went into what he called the drifting mode. He just let the capsule twist into any attitude it wanted, as Scott had on his final orbit. I'm having a ball up here drifting, said Wally, enjoying it so much I haven't eaten yet. When he came over California during the fourth orbit, John Glenn, acting as Capcom at Point Arguello, was instructed to have Wally say something for a live broadcast over television and radio. Ha ha, said Wally. I suppose an old song, Drifting and Dreaming, would be apropos at this point, but at this point, I don't have a chance to dream. I'm enjoying it too much. When he was over South America, he was asked to say something in Spanish for a live broadcast. Buenos dias, you all, said Wally, and the Latins loved it. After nearly four orbits, drifting and yakking and yucking and up, cool, relaxed, to turtle to the last, Wally had used up barely 10% of his hydrogen peroxide. He had already traveled one orbit farther than Carpenter or Glenn. He had floated every inch of the way, and as Scott had told him, there was nothing to it. There was no sensation of up or down in weightless flight. It was obvious that you could send a Mercury capsule on a 17-orbit flight like Titov's if you wanted. As Shira came over the Cape, Deke Slayton said, Flight would like to talk to you now. Flight meant the flight director, Kraft himself, was coming onto the circuit. Been a real good show up there, said Kraft. I think we are proving our point, old buddy. Glenn was sitting in front of a microphone in the tracking station at Point Arguello. Scott was sitting in front of a microphone in the tracking station at Guaymas. Kraft had never come onto the circuit to say any such thing to either of them. Scott was beginning to see what the point, our point, was. As he neared the completion of his sixth and last orbit, Wally announced that he had 78% of the fuel left in both the automatic and manual systems. He had flown twice as far as Glenn or Carpenter, and he could have gotten through another 15 orbits or so if he had to. One of Kraft's lieutenants, an engineer named Gene Kranz, came on the circuit and said to Wally, Now that's what I call a real engineering test flight. Scott picked up the message in his central nervous system even before his mind analyzed it. Unlike the last one, the man was saying, there was even a hint of unlike the last two. To complete an operational triumph, Schra now had only to land on target. Carpenter had landed 250 miles off the mark. As he began his descent toward the atmosphere, Wally told Al Shepard, the Capcom on Bermuda near the target area, I think they're going to put me on the number three elevator. He was talking about the number three elevator used for moving aircraft up to the flight deck on the carrier Kearsarge. This was a bit of the Shira metonymy for squarely on target. Oh, yes. And in fact, he landed just 4.5 miles from the carrier. The Swabos crowding the flight deck could see him coming down under his big parachute. Carpenter had found the capsule uncomfortably hot once he splashed down and had crawled out through the neck of the capsule and waited on his life raft for the rescue planes. Glenn had also complained of the heat. Shira's suit had an improved cooling system, and he was willing to stay in the capsule indefinitely. He refused a helicopter's offer of a lift to the carrier. What was the rush? He stayed in the capsule while a crew of Swabos in a motor-driven whaling boat towed him back to the carrier. Once he was on the Kearsarge, he told the doctors, I feel fine. It was a textbook flight. The flight went just the way I wanted it to. That became the verdict on Shiraz's performance, a textbook flight. He had done everything on the checklist. He had turned in 100% performance. He had successfully proved that a man could ride around the Earth six times and barely turn a hand or move a muscle and hardly use an ounce of fuel or expend an extra heartbeat and never, not for a moment, surrender to psychological stress. and ride the ship down to a designated drop in the vastness of the ocean. Sigma, Summa, QED, operational. Wally came back to celebrations in Houston and Florida and a big Wally Schirra day in his hometown of Oradell, New Jersey. The next day, he went to the White House for congratulations by President Kennedy, and the president presented him with the Distinguished Service Medal. It all turned out to be rather brief and unceremonious, however, and something of a disappointment. A little chat, a few grins, a few photographs with the chief executive in the Oval Office, and that was it. The date was October 16th. In time, Wally would learn that Kennedy had just seen photographic evidence from U-2 flights that the Soviets had set up missile bases in Cuba. The president had kept his appointment with the astronaut only to maintain appearances, to prevent word from getting out about the critical situation that was developing. Chapter 14. The Club. By and by, Conrad started carrying Glenn's bag, as well as his own, and facing up to the role. It was the only sensible thing to do. Otherwise, the two of them would arrive at some airport, St. Louis, Akron, Los Angeles, wherever, and it would take them 5 minutes to walk 40 feet. The autograph seekers came in waves. Every few steps, Glenn would have to put his bag down and sign some more autographs and shake some more hands. Actually, he was great at it. That big, sunny, freckle-faced smile of his lit up the place. People came up to him as if they knew him personally and loved him. He is my protector. He risked his life and challenged the Russians in the heavens for me. They adored him so much it would have been hard for him to brush past them, even if he had been of that sort of disposition. So he would put his bag down and sign some more autographs, and the two of them would have to stop. If Conrad carried both bags, they could keep moving. Glenn could wave and sign autographs and shake hands and chat and beam that terrific smile at everybody in transit without seeming rude. As for Conrad, he was in absolutely no danger of having to stop and put down the bags. He was now an astronaut officially, but to the mobs of autograph seekers, they couldn't have cared less. He looked like some little guy who carried bags for John Glenn. What was more, that was what he felt like. That was about all the second group of astronauts was doing. Chores for the first, for the one, the only, the original seven. Conrad, as part of his training, had been accompanying Glenn in his travels. Now that Project Mercury was drawing to a close, Glenn was supposed to make Project Apollo, the moon program, his area of specialization. He was visiting the factories of the major contractors, just as he had in the early days of Mercury. Conrad's area of specialization, officially, was cockpit layout and systems integration. But mainly, he was with John Glenn. John Glenn, visiting the factory, took on the aura of the general coming to inspect the troops. He was a magnet for every sort of VIP who could get next to him, particularly congressmen and senators. There were times when senators actually pushed, elbowed, hipped, bellied secretaries, stenographers, and other mere gawkers out of the way to get next to Glenn's fabled hide and speak to him and grin a great deal. Standing by, all the while, would be an unknown young man, the single combat hero's valet, apparently his Batman, as the British Army called military servants. Namely, the anonymous Lieutenant Conrad, Group 2 astronaut. Nevertheless, Conrad had made it this time, and that was the main thing. That was all that any really competitive military pilot upon the great ziggurat could focus on anymore, becoming an astronaut. By now, only 3 years later, any such session as he and Wally Schirra and Alan Shepard and Jim Lovell and the others had gone through at the Marriott Motel in February of 1959, it was hard to believe it could have ever taken place. Remember Wally that night? Wally! Adding up the pros and cons and agonizing over what the space program might do to his chances of commanding a squadron of F-4Hs. And now Wally, the same Wally with whom they had gone water skiing on Chesapeake Bay, with whom they had weathered the bad string at Pax River, the old affable prankster himself, now Wally stood at the very apex of the great invisible pyramid of flying. for the seven Mercury astronauts had become the true Brotherhood. They were so dazzling, you couldn't even see the erstwhile true brethren of Edwards Air Force Base any longer. In April, when NASA announced it was accepting applications for a second group of astronauts, both Conrad and Jim Lovell had looked like good bets this time around, since they had been among the 31 finalists in the original selection process.